remained darkened by shadows like empty eye sockets. Though the houses were similar in style to the academic buildings were even older. The city had grown up around the school, and the name Selium was interchangeable between the two. Stevic rode beneath the Pedrosian arch, which marked the entrance to campus. He admired the scrollwork and detail carved into its marble facade. On the keystone was a half-man, half-moose creature, blowing on a horn. His features were scrubbed away by hundreds of years of harsh winters, and his body, like the rest of the arch, was splotched with lichens. Was the Pedros a mythological species or a lost race? It was like asking if the god Eric rode the crescent moon in the evening. He couldn't see it happen, therefore he could not know in truth. Once he had thought Selium contained the answers to all such questions, but time and maturity had taught him the answers were all open to interpretation. If he believed the Pedros existed, did it make it so? His fingers dragged along the inscription inside the arch as he rode beneath. He couldn't read the ancient Sacheridian script, but he remembered that the words roughly meant that knowledge brought peace. In fact, the school had risen from the ashes and death of the Long War with the optimistic goal of ending all war with knowledge. A lofty ideal? Not really, considering Sacheridia had been a relatively peaceful nation for hundreds of years. Other countries, once members of the League that had crushed down the dark forces of Mournhaven the Black, were less peaceful than Sacheridia, but still sent children to be educated here. A sign of hope for future generations, not to be discounted. At the school stables, Stevic handed the reins over to a boy and tossed him a copper.
"Thank you, my lord,"
the boy said in astonishment. Evidently tips were uncommon.
"I am no lord, boy. Remember that."
Yes, sir.
Stevic strode toward the administration building, with its golden dome and marble colonnade, his royal blue cloak flowing behind him. Well over 6 feet tall, he was an imposing man with a set chin and wide shoulders. Brown hair, flecked with silver, hung long and loose. Despite his rich silks and the presumed leisure which accompanied wealth, he wasn't in any way soft. His body, for all its height, was hard and compact from years of hoisting cargo. Most merchants of his status sat in their offices counting their currency, but Stevic was different. He would not make his men and women do what he himself could not do. It wasn't uncommon to see him on the docks, sleeves rolled up, throwing heavy kegs up to a cog's crew. It also wasn't uncommon for him to be called a lord, for his bearing and composure, his self-confidence and commanding presence, were those of a nobleman. He would have none of it. He was proud of his simple roots, proud of the hard work that had attained the success he now enjoyed. He scorned royalty on the most part, and he was heard to mutter, more than once, that royals didn't have the sense of a horse's ass. A gold ring flashed on Stevic's finger as he entered the dim administration building. It bore the clan emblem, the twin of the one his beloved Carony had once worn. Upon her death, it had been passed on to Kerrigan. Whenever he looked at his daughter, he saw Carony, her high forehead and bright eyes. Kerrigan had not inherited her quiet ways, however, but her father's own temper. Stevic's footfalls echoed loudly in the lobby. It was a domed rotunda with a veined marble floor, bronze statues and busts of past administrators, stern and staid scholars, and severe-looking craftmasters frowned at him from their alcoves. Offices branched off in either direction in rows of oak doors. A bald-pated clerk sat at a desk, crouched over a sheaf of papers. Stevic stood before him some moments before the clerk acknowledged his presence with a sniff and nasal,
"Yes?"
"I'm here to see Dean Geyer."
"Dean Geyer is in a meeting."
The man stuck his nose back into his papers and proceeded to ignore Stevic. Bureaucrats, Stevic knew, could be worse than aristocrats. As a merchant, he had dealt with his share of tax collectors and trade officials.
"I will see the dean now."
"Have you an appointment?"
"Of sorts."
"There are no appointments scheduled on the roster at this time."
The clerk didn't even glance at the appointment book on his desk.
I received a letter from Dean Geyer instructing me to visit when I arrived. Do you have it with you?
Stevic frowned.
It was destroyed.
I see.
Though Stevic towered above, the clerk still managed to look down his nose at him.
Dean Geyer is busy. Either you have an appointment or you do not.
Stevic wondered if the clerk gave the royals the same runaround, or if they received special treatment. He placed his hands on the clerk's neat desk and leaned down so he could look the man in the eye.
You will create an appointment for me now, or by Brienne's gold, I'll inform the dean that his clerk is reading poetry rather than attending to his duty.
The clerk licked his lips and gulped nervously.
Very well, but the dean will be annoyed. I pay this school handsomely so my daughter can attend. I expect some of that tuition goes towards your salary, and that of the dean. I do not think it unreasonable that the dean see me now. Of course, my lord.
So the clerk did treat royals the same way. Perhaps he wasn't so bad after all.
I am no lord. I am Stevic Glathian, chieftain of the clan Glathian, at your service.
He put his hand to his heart and bowed slightly, as was customary. The clerk sniffed as he took in the fine clothing.
Oh, a merchant, I suppose. Very well. Follow me.
He hoisted his robes of office and strode across the lobby, his sandals whispering on the marble floor. They mounted two sets of spiraling stairs carpeted with rich red pile and zigzagged through numerous branching corridors before halting before enormous double doors of oak. The clerk hesitated and glanced over his shoulder at Stevic. Noting the merchant's expression of resolve, he licked his lips and knocked.
Who is it?
Barked a voice from within.
Dean Geyer, Oh, Myrtle. Come in.
The clerk shrugged and pushed the doors open. Dean Geyer, a distinguished-looking man with snowy hair and bright blue eyes, sat at his vast desk, just about to insert a mast into the upper deck of a large model ship.
I see how busy he is,
Stevic whispered to the clerk. Matterly reddened. The dean cleared his throat when he noticed Stevic and pushed the model aside. He stared at the clerk, awaiting an explanation.
Chief Stevic Glathian to see you, Dean,
Matterly said. He backed out of the office without another word, pulling the doors shut as he went. Stevic ignored the impressive collection of books on the dean's shelves and the rare hand-drawn maps framed on the wall that would have ordinarily intrigued him. He stepped right up to the desk and focused his attention on the ship model, examining it carefully.
I've sailed a few of these square riggers myself, he said.
Geyer ran his fingers through his white hair and chuckled nervously, like a child caught with his finger dipped in the honeypot.
I tried sailing once or twice, but the seasickness, you know.
Stevic scrunched his brows together.
You've glued the bowsprit to the stern.
He clucked in dismay.
And see here?
He pointed to the rear of the model.
You've put the jib where the spanker belongs.
He stood straight, feet spread and hands on hips, and turned his attention on the dean. He surveyed the dean as critically as he had the model, as if something was out of place. Geyer swallowed and twisted a length of twine around his little finger. He tried to speak, but under Stevic's stern appraisal, no words came out.
I beg your pardon for this intrusion, Dean,
Stevic said finally.
But your letter demanded immediate attention. I haven't even been to see my daughter yet.
The dean paled and seemed to quiver. Then he mastered himself and pointed at a chair on the other side of his desk.
Of course. Please, sit. You must be weary after such a long journey. From Corsa, if I'm not mistaken.
You are not mistaken.
Stevic pulled up a leather-upholstered chair.
And I will sit, though I'm not tired. What I really want, Dean, is answers. Why is my daughter being expelled from school?
Dean Geyer changed the arrangement of his glue pot and carving knives on his desktop and picked up an unattached model mast, which he rolled between his fingers. He seemed unwilling to look Stevic in the eye.
Not expelled, not exactly. Suspended. You see, her grades were dwindling, and she'd been picking fights with other students. Those are no reasons for a suspension.
I'm afraid they are.
We do not abide schoolyard brawls. Fighting is not in keeping with the principles of the school.
Brawls, Stevic said.
My daughter does not participate in brawls.
The dean pushed his fingers together in a triangle. A smile fluttered on his lips.
A fight, then. A fight which she initiated. Fortunately, the other student involved was not hurt. I don't believe it. Perhaps you do not, but the student's family complained to the trustees. You must also know she was not doing well academically.
The dean relaxed as he explained Kerrigan's shortcomings.
She hardly attended her classes, and even when she did, her grades were still mediocre, not in keeping with our standards. That alone would be enough for dismissal. With this as her background, and a fight she provoked as cause, the trustees determined Kerrigan should spend some time at home, and reconsider her reasons for being here.
Stevic's face flushed an angry red.
My daughter is not mediocre, nor is she a bully who goes about provoking fights.
Geyer spread his hands wide to indicate the matter was beyond his control.
As a parent, you are entitled to feel that way about your child. Needless to say, the trustees have formed another opinion about her. It is hoped that upon reconsidering her behavior of the past, she will change her ways and return to Selium. In time.
Stevic gripped the arms of his chair, feeling as if he would explode.
I would talk with your trustees. If I don't receive satisfaction, my donations to this institution will cease. I will talk to the Golden Guardian himself if I must. But first, I wish to see my daughter. I have yet to hear her side of the tale.
Geyer blanched again.
She isn't home? You haven't seen her? Of course not. I told you. What's going on here? Where is my daughter?
The dean mumbled to himself and looked around his office, as if seeing it for the first time. Stevic felt he would strangle the dean with a strand of the model ship's rigging. For all, he could not seem to say anything. Geyer gathered his courage, but he couldn't bring himself to look in Stevic Glathian's eyes.
She ran away. I was the last to see her.
Stevic struck the flat of his hand on Geyer's desk. Papers flew off, and the ship model shuddered. A freshly glued mast toppled over and clattered onto the desktop.
My daughter is missing?
Stevic lowered his voice to a hoarse growl.
I thought more of Selium than this.
He pointed a shaking finger at the dean.
I hold you responsible for her being missing. I demand to see Guardian Fiori at once.
Geyer cringed in his chair.
The Guardian isn't...
Stevic didn't wait to hear the rest. He threw the double doors open, stormed out of Dean Geyer's office, and searched up and down corridors for the Golden Guardian's office. He flung doors open, startling administrators and disrupting classes. He pushed clerks out of his way when they blocked passageways. Exclamations and curses followed in his wake. When he thought he had searched every office, he found another corridor branching off from one of the main ones. He struck off down the poorly lit corridor, not slackening his stride. Candles ensconced on the wall sputtered at his passing. The rich red pile disappeared, revealing scuffed and scarred floorboards. Finally, he came upon a door adorned simply with the symbol of the Golden Harp. He opened it and entered. The office was a disarray of musical instruments. They hung on the walls, lay on shelves, and leaned in corners. Some were in pieces or had broken strings curling crazily from tuning pegs. Countless books were stacked on the floor. There was no space on the shelves for them. A thick layer of dust coated everything, and the scent of resin hung thick in the air.
This is the Golden Guardian's office?
Stevic said with incredulity. As a matter of fact, it is. Beyond the plain pinewood desk in the center of the room, a girl in a uniform of indigo with a white apprentice knot at the shoulder looked up with sea-green eyes from the book she had been reading.
I beg your pardon, Stevic said. but I need to see Guardian Fiore.
The girl's book thumped closed, and she sighed.
I'd like to see him myself, but he's the only one who knows where he is.
Stevic waited for an explanation, but the girl seemed to have sunk into her own thoughts and didn't go on.
Ahem, he prompted. What do you mean?
He's doing what a minstrel does best. He's journeying. He could be in the Northlands, Ullambay, or Rovni, for all I know. He never knows where he'll be until he's there. He has been gone up to a year, and longer than that before I came to live with him.
Stevic reckoned himself open-minded, but this girl was no older than his Kerrigan. It was rumored that the Golden Guardian was well into his 60s, and though it was not unusual for older men to wed younger women primed to bear children, this age discrepancy was criminal. He stalked over to a dusty window that overlooked the campus. A bell chimed 4 times, resonating through the floorboards, as if it must be very close. Students poured out of buildings and onto the square below, changing classes. Kerrigan should be among them, but she wasn't. Where was she? On the road home, he hoped. A pigeon perched on the windowsill.
Some Governor Fiore is, if he isn't here to watch over his interests.
Pardon? The girl asked. I don't hear well. It's best if you face me.
Stevic turned in surprise. This wasn't Fiore's wife at all, but his daughter. He reddened in embarrassment.
You're Kerrigan's friend, aren't you? Young Estrel.
Kerrigan had spoken of Estrel, saying that she was deaf in one ear from an accident, but still a fabulous musician. The girl nodded with a smile.
And you're her father?
Then her face grew serious.
You haven't seen Kerrigan, have you?
No. I expected to find her here. Either a message she had run away didn't reach me before I left Corsa, or the Dean didn't bother to send me one.
The anger began to build within him again, like a fire scorching his belly.
I hold Dean Gaia responsible for this. If anything has happened to Kerrigan...
It's terrible.
Estrel's shoulders sagged, and she rested her chin on her hands.
I wish she'd come back. I miss her. It hasn't been the same here without her. I've no one to talk to, and the other students pester me worse than usual. She used to sort of protect me. I don't know why she ran away. Did you know her grades were improving and that Armsmaster Rendell had taken her on as a student just before she was suspended?
Your story differs from the Dean's,
Stevic said.
You say Kerrigan left no clue as to where she went.
No, and I wouldn't blame the Dean too much. He's a little out of touch and perhaps too much at the sway of the trustees. After all, it was an aristocrat Kerrigan fought.
An aristocrat?
Lord Governor Merwell's heir. He was humiliated after she beat him at swordplay.
Never heard of anything good coming out of Merwell.
Stavik's caravans rarely traveled there. The common folk were, on the most part, too poor to purchase his goods, and the wealthy were more interested in arms, which he didn't sell.
Estrel continued. It created a sensation all over town.
Stevic grinned mirthlessly.
Sounds like something she would do.
Estrel shook her head.
She never knew it, but she had more friends than she ever realized because she stood up to bullies like Temus. A lot of the students here are not of noble blood or wealth, but are full of talent. Father makes a point of searching for such children and bringing them to Selium. They are often at the mercy of those such as Temus.
And instead of playing along, she stood against the ruffians.
Stevic rubbed his chin.
Yes, that is like her.
The office door creaked open. Stevic started in surprise as the green rider he had seen earlier with the Undertaker walked in. She still clutched the arrows, black-shafted, he saw, her brow furrowed with anger.
I wish to see Guardian Fiore, she said.
The corners of her eyes were creased from too many years in the sun, and her cheeks were sprinkled with faded freckles. Her hair, which had looked so intense outside, now appeared a burnished auburn, with a streak of gray sweeping from her temple. Hazel eyes sparkled alertly, no doubt taking in every detail of the Golden Guardian's disheveled office. Her nose was disjointed, as if it had been broken once, and a badly healed scar ran raggedly down her chin and neck in a brown line until it disappeared beneath her collar.
I'm sorry, but he's away, Estrel said. The lines across the rider's brow deepened. You are being honest with me? I can sense falsehoods if I so choose. She fingered a brooch on her short coat. Stevic hadn't noticed it before, and even now couldn't seem to make out its shape or design.
I've no reason to lie to you, Estrel said. My father is traveling.
Your father? You're not one of those idiot clerks. Please forgive me. Her voice was chagrined, and it was difficult to imagine her as the same woman who had shaken the undertaker by his lapels. Stevic wondered if she had given the clerk Matterly similar treatment. I was hoping he could help me identify this talisman. She held the arrows aloft. The steel barbed tips were encrusted with dry blood. There are words carved on them in a language I can't quite make out, but I have my own thoughts. They've the feel of magic. Very old magic. Estrel gazed at them with some interest, but didn't ask to hold them.
I'm sorry Father isn't here. Maybe Master Galwin could help. He's a historian and the school curator. He studies the lore of old magic. Where did you find them?
In the back of one of my finest riders, she sighed. We believe he was bringing us a message of some significance. Then, as an afterthought, she introduced herself. I am Laren Mapstone, captain of His Majesty's Messenger Service. Your father has been very helpful to me in the past, that is, dealing with objects of antiquity and magic.
Ach, Stevic said. Magic is evil.
He made the sign of the half-moon with his fingers to ward off any magic that might be conjured up just by mentioning it. Captain Mapstone gave him a long, measuring look. Her head did not even reach his shoulders, but her bearing made her seem equally tall. And who are you?
Chief Stevic Glavion, at your service.
He bowed deeper for her than he had for the clerk. Oh, a merchant. Obviously with backward views. Magic is magic. It's the user who makes it evil or good.
I still wouldn't touch it.
The green rider's lips drew back into what could have been a smile. There are those who still touch magic and use it, despite the denial this country has been immersed in for the last several centuries. Before Stevic could retort, the door creaked open again. This time, a man of wiry and well-muscled build walked in. His hair was steel-gray, but his mustache and eyes were as black as night. A pipe protruded from his shirt pocket.
Pardon my intrusion, Estrel, he said, but I hear that Kerrigan's father is here.
Estrel nodded toward Stevic. That's him, Master Rendell.
Arms, Master Rendell?
Stevic stepped past Captain Mapstone to greet the man. He forgot to bow.
Pleased to meet. We've a few things to discuss.
Estrel's chair scraped the floor as she stood up.
Guess I'm not going to get anything done here. Nobody ever bothers to come back here except when I have to study.
If you could direct me to Master Galwin, the Green Rider requested, and followed Estrel out. The armsmaster watched after them.
A dangerous job that rider has. How's that?
Rendell shook himself as if he hadn't realized he'd spoken aloud.
Can you imagine riding all hours of the day, at the mercy of weather, during all seasons? Can you imagine bearing a message through dangerous territories, or taking bad news to a short-tempered lord who wouldn't think twice about killing you? Can you imagine carrying a message someone doesn't want delivered? The lifespan of a green rider is very short. That captain is about as old as I see them get. That's all very well, but it's their job. Why, sometimes it's no better for a merchant traveling with a load of goods. Unless you've a full complement of guards. I know plenty of merchants who have been killed for... Aye, it's their job. And green riders are the closest to insane as I've ever seen.
Unsettled by the armsmaster's words, Stevic watched out the dusty window as Captain Mapstone and Estrel crossed the courtyard down below.
Tell me about my daughter.
Armsmaster Rendell leaned against the Golden Guardian's desk, his arms folded across his broad chest.
By the end of the fight, he was saying, I saw enough to recognize she had some natural talent with the sword. It was the way she moved. It was raw and instinctual, but I saw promise. You must understand that most of the students who come to me are there mostly because it is part of their coursework, or a clan tradition to receive weapons training. They hone traditional skills. It is unlikely
they will ever use. Minstrel students are more musician than warrior. But weapons training is required for them. The Guardian believes they should be prepared for the world they wander in, and I quite agree. But it is rare to find a student with actual interest and talent.
Stevic stared out the window. The courtyard had fallen into shadow and silence, empty of students. Even the pigeons seemed to have fled the grounds, giving it a gloomy and abandoned feel.
I had hoped Kerrigan would find a talent for something, but I never expected the sword.
Ah, but the sword is just a beginning. I had heard about her from her other instructors. Complaints, mind you. Except from her riding instructor, Master Delian. Del said she excelled at riding. When I saw Kerrigan put Teemis Merwell on the ground, I thought maybe I could get her to work for something else and the sword would be just the beginning. That it would inspire her to seek out whatever it was she wanted to do with her life.
Stevic turned his gaze to the arms master.
I am fortunate my daughter had such an instructor.
Rendell grinned.
She was fortunate to have such a father.
Stevic raised a brow.
I once asked her what she wanted to do with her life, Rendell said. She told me something adventurous. She wanted to be a merchant, like her father. It is not many children who choose to follow their parents' footsteps.
Stevic stilled, letting it sink in. Then he slowly shook his head and turned back to the window and the shadows. He felt buffeted by a variety of emotions, elation, fear, sadness, desperation. Where was she?
She never told me.
His voice was taut. Rendell said nothing until he was certain Stevic had mastered himself.
We continued training every day. It seems someone had worked with her before. The cargo master.
Stevic nodded.
Savano. Her skills were less than basic, but she was an eager student, always at the practice field early. She worked harder than any student I've had the privilege to teach in a very long time. Her skills improved quickly, though she seemed discouraged by what she saw as a lack of progress. Unfortunately, her training was cut short. The suspension, you mean?
Aye.
Rendell removed his pipe from his pocket and patted his side, as if in search of something, and frowned.
My tobacco pouch.
When he couldn't find it, he stuck the pipe back in his pocket.
Despite the fact that Teemis Merwell attacked her after their swordplay, and despite Del, Master Delian, and myself speaking on her behalf before the trustees, Kerrigan was suspended.
Stevic left the window to stand before Rendell.
I've heard the Dean's explanation, but why do you think she was suspended?
I'm Rovenborn, Rendell said. My mother was of Rovni, my father of Adelin Province. I spent a goodly part of my life on the Wanda Plains, growing more weeds than crops, and fighting off ground mites and other raiders. We were too concerned with day-to-day life to worry about what the clans were doing in Sacaridia. Politics.
Rendell leaned forward, and in a low voice, he said,
At least one trustee is of Clan Merwell. Muellians don't take kindly to dishonor. Kerrigan dishonored the governor's son, thus the entire clan. And they will remember such an insult for a century, if need be.
If need be. Stevic took a deep swallow of his ale and set the tankard down on the knotty pine table with a clunk. It was late afternoon at the Harp and Drum, and no one had begun to entertain yet. The music would start during the supper hour. He didn't think he would have the heart to listen to it anyway. Only a few other patrons sat quietly at tables, sipping wine or ale, as drowsy sunlight filtered through the windows. Stevic twisted the gold ring on his finger, ignoring the steaming fresh bread and cheese plate the innkeeper set on their table.
You think about Kerry?
Savano said. Stevic nodded.
She's my daughter. Just a baby. Oh, no. No baby, is she. Young, yes, but no baby. You know she's got herself into plenty of scrapes before. It's just like her to go home on her own. No waiting around for you to arrive. Not with the humiliation this suspension must have caused her.
I know Gladian pride, I do. He chuckled. If you were her, you'd do the same.
Stevic smiled.
I did do something similar when I was her age. I joined a merchant barge, but she is still your baby.
Sivano shook his head.
She has jumped from her nest. Her wings spread. You would prevent this? No, of course not. Well, you heard all the whisperings of strange things happening as we traveled here. By Brienne's gold, Sivano, strange things were happening all winter. The tree folk have been seen outside of the Eltwood for the first time in at least 100 years, and you heard about ground mites crossing the borders just as I did. Are you saying I shouldn't be worried about my daughter?
No.
The older man stared into his tankard and listlessly picked up a piece of yellow cheese, which he tossed back onto the plate.
I worry too. But remember, I taught her many things about survival, and that Rendel sounds like a good man. I'm sure she learned much from him.
You both taught her swordplay. I don't expect she has a sword of her own.
I taught her much more than the sword I did. She could use her bare hands to defend herself. Like a niece, she is to me too, though no blood do we share.
The two sat in silence for many minutes, the very air pressed on their shoulders. They were awakened from their individual reveries as the door creaked open and blinding sunlight poured into the common room. A young man stepped across the threshold, hesitating a moment, until his eyes adjusted to the dim interior. He was dressed in a waistcoat of green over a white linen shirt. His breeches and the coat he carried, draped over his forearm, were green as well. A saber sheathed in a plain black scabbard was strapped to his waist. Stevic watched as the green rider searched the depths of the common room. The messenger's eyes registered in sudden recognition, and he strode toward them, the soles of his boots making no sound on the wooden floor. Stevic wondered what the rider would want with them, but he didn't stop at their table. Rather, he continued on to the booth behind them. Stevic couldn't see who the young man sat with because of the high backing of the booth, but he instantly recognized the voice. "Conley," said Captain Mapstone. "Good to see you. How was the road?" The rider murmured something imperceptible, and Stevic strained to hear. "I need you to contact Joy about Freyan and his missing message. We need every available rider scouring all roads and towns. Those who are on a run must keep their eyes open. There's no telling where that message is, or if it even still exists. Maybe someone took it from him, or maybe his horse is running loose with the message still snug in its satchel. We must find out. Also, be sure to warn Joy of the manner of his death." Conley murmured some more, but Stevic couldn't make out a word of it. "I don't know," Captain Mapstone replied. "Though I think it very odd that his brooch was missing. It could..." Whatever she was about to say was cut short by a clamor outside. Stevic looked out his window, but could only see people rushing into the street.
"What do you suppose that's all about?"
he asked Sivano.
"Dunno."
Sivano took a final swig of ale and wiped his sleeve across his mouth.
"Let's have a look."
Stevic was reluctant to leave the conversation he had been eavesdropping on, but the booth had become silent anyway. Undoubtedly, the two green riders were distracted by the shouting from outside as well. Stevic pushed his tankard aside and followed Sivano out into the glare of sunshine. He pushed through onlookers to see what was causing such excitement, and stopped in shock. A fallen horse and rider lay in the middle of the street. Blood foamed from the heaving horse's mouth. A youth of dark complexion lay dazed beside it, one leg pinned beneath the horse. Some of the onlookers attempted to free him. The boy seemed oblivious to what was happening around him.
"They killed them!" the boy cried. "They killed the master! Master Ion! Everyone! They killed everyone but me! Monsters! Like men, but not..."
The boy's sobs rang out over the stunned crowd.
"I believe that's Yurith of the Underkingdoms,"
a woman said behind Stevic's right shoulder. "Son of Auskorion, pack leader of Tacatnia. He was on a field trip with his class."
"Someone ought to inform the dean," a man said.
Stevic turned away. The boy's whimpering carried over the chatter of the crowd. The boy's face was clear of tattoos, making him an adolescent who hadn't yet made the Great Hunt, the traditional rite to become a man of the pack.
"He's Kerrigan's age,"
he said to Savanno.
"Aye, well do I know it."
Captain Mapstone watched the commotion from the steps of the inn. Her expression was thoughtful. Stevic walked over to her purposefully, and she shook out of some uncomfortable reverie as he approached.
"Ground mites," she said. "Those monsters he saw were ground mites."
Stevic felt his stomach lurch. Where was his daughter?
"Captain, I would ask a favor."
She raised a copper brow. A merchant always seeks favors at no cost to himself, which he rarely repays. Stevic's cheeks burned in anger.
"Perhaps it's true with some merchants, just as it's true with some minstrels, soldiers, craftmasters, farmers and ferrymen. But I am not of that nature."
Captain Mapstone's expression remained unaltered, and she did not apologize. "What favor do you ask?"
It would mean much to me if your riders could watch for a young girl, the same age as this youth here who now lies in the street. She has disappeared, and she's my daughter. I believe she is traveling toward Corsa, but who can say if something ill has befallen her?"
The captain blinked, but it was her only change of expression. "Green riders aren't in the habit of searching for runaways, Chief, and at the moment we're involved in—"
"I implore you, Captain."
Stevic's voice cracked as he spoke.
"My daughter has been missing for weeks. She is all I have left since my wife died. Surely, taking the girl's description and passing it on to your riders won't distract them from their duty."
Stevic had forgotten Savanno behind him and was suddenly grateful for his presence.
"It is but a small thing to ask. She is young and alone. What if she meets up with ground mites, like that lad yonder? I will more than repay you if your people can find Kerrigan."
Stevic looked hopefully at her. They were now eye level, the steps she stood on helping her to meet his gaze. He saw her expression soften just the least bit.
"I will make donations to your unit. I'll re-outfit your riders."
Now there was a perceptible hint of a smile on her face. She turned toward the interior of the inn.
"Conley, I need you to take a description. Come, listen, and listen well."
As the young man trotted to the doorway, she turned back to Stevic and said, "I intend to keep you to your end of the bargain."
Swordmasters. Kerrigan and her captors walked in the same formation as they had the previous day. Garoti sat upon his horse, talking down at Torn, who strode beside him. Jindara, leading the horse, walked next to Kerrigan. Kerrigan had spent an unpleasant night listening to Torn and Garoti swap tales and make suggestive, if not entirely vulgar, comments about her. She hadn't slept all night, and now her eyelids sagged as she stumbled down the road. Her wrists itched. Either they were healing from the burns or they were getting worse. The rope that bound her wrists made it impossible to check beneath the old, dirty dressings that covered the wounds. Jindara had kept silent all day. Torn and Garoti directed some comments her way, too. She merely scowled at their backs, as if to burn holes through them with her eyes.
"I'd castrate those two."
Kerrigan tripped over a rock. Jindara speaking aloud was unexpected enough. Her words, even more so.
"Why don't you?"
Jindara chuckled.
"Two of them against me, and one a sword master at that. The odds are a bit precarious, don't you think?"
"I'd help."
"Very helpful you would be. I doubt you can even lift that sword fastened to your saddle. All they need greenies to do is ride."
Kerrigan, of course, had little idea what green riders were capable of, but was certain she could surprise even Jindara with a few of the skills she had learned, whether Jindara was a swordmaster or not.
"This road goes on forever," Kerrigan said. "It was built long ago to breach the northern wilderness."
Jindara's reply was again unexpected.
"Where do you think all the pulp that makes paper comes from? There isn't nearly the expanse of woods to the south."
Ribbons of sun dropped through the trees, leaving puddles of light on the road and in the woods. Kerrigan caught movement in the woods out of the corner of her eye. She looked closely, but at first she couldn't focus on the shape. She blinked,
and the shape slowly defined itself into a man. Another traveler walking abreast of them in the woods, fading in and out of the shadows, weaving between the trees, striding swiftly and unhindered through the underbrush, as if he were on a smooth road. His passage was silent, not a snap of a twig to be heard, not a single bird flushed from cover. Tall ferns and tree limbs swayed in a breeze, not from the touch of the man who seemed to pass right through, without brushing a thing. The horse whickered and watched the traveler, his ears pricked forward.
"What does he see?"
Jindara asked. She looked right at the traveler, and through him. Torn and Garoti chattered, oblivious to the newcomer. Kerrigan narrowed her eyes and saw the traveler's pale face and two arrows sticking from his back. Freean Kobolbe. He turned to her, still keeping pace with them. His mouth worked as if he were trying to tell her something, but she couldn't hear words. He kept speaking until he passed through the shadow of a tall hemlock and disappeared. The horse champed the bit and sidestepped in a skittish way. Maybe he could hear the voice of the ghost. Watch as she might throughout the day, Kerrigan saw no further signs of Freean Kobolbe. What message had he been trying to convey? Jindara had asked at one point what it was she saw, or expected to see, in the woods. "Just ghosts," she said matter-of-factly. "A spirit follows me." Jindara frowned. The two men overheard, and while Garoti guffawed loudly, Torn growled.
"I ought to cut your tongue out. Your superstitious talk won't work with me. You actually sound worried, Torn."
Tobacco juice slapped the road. Garoti wiped his mouth with the back of his hand.
"Are you superstitious? You, a sword master and grown man?"
Torn glowered.
"Of course not. Those Moellian fools brought it up first, and this greenie is trying to make us nervous. Won't work, greenie. Won't work."
Kerrigan shrugged. She had spoken plain truth, which she believed Torn and Jindara must have sensed, despite their protests, for they began searching the woods with their eyes, and their pace had picked up. Garoti chuckled.
"All of this plain living has gotten to you. Why, if you'd stayed with the Talons a little longer, we could have taught you a few things. We are comfortable where we are."
Now Garoti had managed to prickle even Torn.
"As comfortable as we ever were in Saka City. Why we were sent on this mission, we don't know, and will not question. What my lord wills, my lord receives, and time spent with the Talons has nothing to do with it." "You are infants lost in the woods," Garoti said. "I bet your horses were stolen right from under you."
At Torn's glower, he let out a great,
"Ha!"
and,
"I guessed right. And if you took that leather jerkin off, I bet I could count your ribs, weapons and sword masters indeed. You may survive in the court, but out here is where it counts."
Kerrigan could nearly see the smoke pouring out of Torn's ears. With a yawn, she listened closely as Garoti and Torn continued their debate.
"The problem with you weapons,"
Garoti said, scraping bristly hairs on his cheek,
"is that you're all honor and ceremony. Honor and ceremony may work in court and in battle, but it won't do much good out here. Even the blood god of Ruvni leave the court once in a while to see what the world looks like. Ceremony is deeply traditional among weapons of the Order of Black Shields,"
Torn said.
"Ceremony instills discipline. Besides, who needs to know of the real world when the court is the real world? Jindara and I, well, our circumstances are special. Ah, and if any of Zachary's soldiers see you and recognize you, you'll be hanged as traitors, at the least."
"We aren't traitors, Garoti."
"I suppose that depends on who you work for, then. Zachary or his brother. But hear this, Swordmaster. Zachary is the one in power. He was the one named heir by his father, not Hamilton, no matter the usual order of succession. What you've done is high treason, and if you get caught and strung up, you will be let off easy, I assure you. If I recall history, there was a traitorous weapon named Savril who was slowly tortured for weeks. and then chained to the prison tower for the vultures to feed on. He was still alive.
We know the consequences of our loyalties, Torn said. Tales of Severil the traitor were drilled into our memories when we were mere pledges at the Academy. You don't have to remind us.
Garrote shrugged.
Don't misunderstand me. I'm all for fighting on behalf of the highest bidder, even if the stakes are a little high. What I'm simply trying to say is that you, a weapon whose honor and ideals go beyond payment, should make very sure the stakes are worth the price you may have to pay, and that you will succeed.
The stakes are worth it, Torn said, barely above a whisper, and we will succeed.
Another blob of tobacco juice hit the road in reply. The debate ended there. The shadows of evening deepened, and the air became heavy with dew. Fireflies blinked, falling like flurries of light between the trees. Thrushes sang their evening songs, and as night descended, milky moonlight spilled into the woods. Torn led them off the road and into the clearing where they set up camp. Kerrigan was thrown her usual hard chunk of bread and was thankful as ever for the cache of food in her pockets given to her by Little Dusty. The cache wouldn't last much longer, and soon she'd go hungry again, unless she escaped. Her stomach grumbled as the scent of meat drifted from the mercenary's cookfire. Torn tossed pieces of dried meat into the stew pot. Garrote stared at Kerrigan during the whole meal, stew dribbling out the corner of his mouth, which he roughly wiped away with the back of his hand. Repulsed, Kerrigan looked elsewhere, trying to focus on more pleasant thoughts. Maybe her father was looking for her by now. Surely Dean Geyer had sent him a message about her running away. Well, that wasn't exactly a pleasant thought either. Her father was going to be irate when he found her. After all, it was the beginning of the spring trading season. Any delay in sending out the caravans or barges could prove costly. Torn stood up and stretched.
I'm going to scout for Imrez,
he announced.
That fool should have caught up with us days ago.
He buckled on his sword belt, wrapped his worn cloak about his shoulders, and strode out of camp.
Watch out for ghosties,
Garrote taunted, chuckling heartily. Torn's step faltered as he disappeared into the night. Silence filled the clearing. Garrote pinched a wad of tobacco from his belt pouch and stuffed it into his cheek. His gaze drifted from Kerrigan to Jindara and back again. He leaned back onto his elbows, chewing at his ease. Jindara's expression was stony as she drew her sword from its sheath. From a pouch, she removed a soft cloth, oil, and two wedding stones. The hiss of blade against stone filled the clearing.
I love women who carry weapons, Garrote said. The danger of it excites me.
The hissing ceased.
You're a foul man, Garrote. Be silent before you lose something very precious to you.
Garrote laughed.
It sounds like a challenge to me.
I've been wanting to unman you since I first laid eyes on you.
Then go at it, woman. I'll have fun stopping you.
Kerrigan tensed as Jindara gripped the hilt of her sword and leapt lightly to her feet. Garrote did nothing, and Jindara hesitated.
Well, woman, come on. I'm waiting.
Jindara snarled.
Stand up. If you're a warrior, you will fight like one.
Garrote chuckled and slowly pushed himself up from the ground. He stood with his arms spread out wide.
I'm standing, woman. Come for me, and I'll show you my blade.
A howling pierced the forest, almost human in its cry, followed by the trampling of foliage. The horses whickered nervously.
What was that?
Jindara asked. Garrote shrugged, unconcerned.
Probably some wolf looking for dinner.
Then, with a wicked grin, he added,
Maybe it's found Torn.
Jindara muttered under her breath, looking from the mercenary to Kerrigan.
I'm going to check it out, she said.
Glaring at Garrote, she added,
Leave the prisoner alone.
She held her sword before her and stepped uncertainly into the darkness, in the direction of the disturbance. Kerrigan looked pleadingly after her retreating back. When Jindara was out of sight, Garrote shook his head.
Foolish woman. Just a coyote chasing a hare, I'll reckon. The horses are quiet now, like nothing happened. No matter.
He turned his eyes back on Kerrigan.
It will give us a little time alone.
Don't come near me.
Kerrigan's voice quavered as she spoke. Garrote was across the clearing in three strides. He seized her arm, and lest she cry out loud enough for Jindara to hear, he clamped a sweaty hand over her mouth. He yanked her to her feet, and before she could squirm away, he wrapped his arm around her chest and held her securely. If only her hands weren't tied.
I've been waiting for this.
His hot breath filled her ear damply as he spoke, and smelled of stale tobacco. Garrote dragged her beyond the clearing into the dark of the forest. She kicked and writhed, but the man must have a hide like boiled leather. She raked his shin with the sole of her boot, a trick taught her by the cargo master, but it didn't faze him one iota. Most people would have screamed with pain. Minutes passed like hours as Garrote dragged her, and then threw her to the ground. The barest shred of moonlight fell across his face, revealing a sickening grin.
I've been waiting for this, he repeated.
With a childlike giggle, he unbuckled his sword belt and dropped it to the ground. Kerrigan rolled over and started to crawl away, but Garrote caught her in the small of her back with his foot and ground her into the dirt. She gasped for air.
If you fight, he warned her, I can easily break your spine.
He let his foot rest there for a moment, pressing down when she moved the slightest bit. Then he pulled it away, caught her under the ribs with his toe, and rolled her onto her back again. Kerrigan gasped for breath, her side throbbing with pain. Garrote fell to his knees and straddled her. The stench of his unclean body was overpowering. His very sweat reeked of tobacco. Tobacco drooled from his mouth and stained her shirt. Kerrigan shook uncontrollably.
Fight, fool!
It was a voice Kerrigan remembered, the voice she had heard that night in the settlement. Garrote's hands now pinned her shoulders to the ground. His expression was rabid.
Fight!
The voice commanded. Yes, fight. The cargo master had taught her several tricks. Should she ever be in a situation such as this, she lunged and sank her teeth into Garrote's wrist. He screamed and yanked his hand away, almost snapping her head off her neck with the force. He growled and struck her across the face. The blow sent reverberations ringing through her body, and she blinked dazedly. Garrote examined his wrist. This distraction might be her only chance. He was vulnerable with his legs spread above her as they were. She locked both hands into a single fist and punched upward. Garrote's jaw fell slack, as if uttering a silent cry. His eyes bulged like a fish's, and he clutched his crotch. Kerrigan poised to punch his ugly face in when she heard Jindara's laughter. The swordmaster sheathed her blade and crouched beside them.
Seems I underestimated you, girl. You don't need a sword to unman this idiot.
She chuckled mirthfully at Garrote.
You like dangerous women, do you? It seems to me it would be of service to all women if we permanently crippled you.
She reached for her dagger. Garrote's face swelled with such blood that Kerrigan thought it might explode. Instead, his fist slammed into Jindara's face. The impact sent her flailing backward, her head striking the ground hard. She didn't move. Garrote grunted in satisfaction and leered down at Kerrigan.
This is going to be more interesting than I thought. When I'm through with you, I'll finish off with her, whether she wakes up or not.
Not willing to leave himself unprotected a second time, he grabbed both of Kerrigan's wrists and knelt across her legs. Kerrigan thought desperately. She thought back to summer evenings in an empty warehouse on her father's estate, where the cargo master practiced swordplay with her. For one lesson, he left the wooden practice swords leaning against the wall and devoted the session to what she could do with her bare hands.
Now, Cuddy,
Savano had said, as she sat cross-legged on the dirt floor.
There may be a time when no weapon you've got. I'm gonna show you how to use your hands and feet to maim, and if need be, kill some thug who tries to harm you. But first, let me tell you, where it's gonna hurt him most.
She had tried Garoti's shins and groin already. What was left?
She couldn't pinch the nerves in his hands, and she couldn't kick. She was too immobilized by him to do anything. Savano would disagree, though. She thought frantically. Once she decided, she breathed a short prayer and gathered herself up. Propelled by her elbows and shoulders, she slammed her head into Garoti's face. Not a precision move, but it would have to do. There was a muffled cry, and he fell back, clutching his nose. Blood was splattered across his face. He curled into a fetal position on the ground, writhing in pain. Kerrigan dared not breathe, fearing she had not damaged him sufficiently, and that he would be back on her to finish what he had begun. But he didn't get up, and after several minutes, he stopped moving altogether. She crawled to him on knees and elbows, and saw that his chest did not rise or fall. The cargo master had said that if the nose was bashed into an assailant's head, the bone would shatter and pierce the brain, killing him. Kerrigan had killed a man. She had killed Garoti and was appalled because it did not bother her. Jindara still lay unmoving, rivulets of blood trickling down her cheeks from her nose. She wasn't dead, for she breathed, but she didn't look likely to wake up in the next few moments. This was Kerrigan's chance for escape. She espied Garoti's discarded sword and drew it. She rubbed the rope that bound her hands against the blade, carefully, so she wouldn't slice herself. With relief bordering on joy, she watched the rope fall away. Her hands were free. She hastened to her feet to run to the horse, but paused. The ring of Carani Glathian gleamed in the moonlight on Jindara's hand. Kerrigan slid it off the swordmaster's calloused finger and onto her own. It had always been a little loose on her, but now it fit perfectly. A twig crunched behind her. Kerrigan whirled around.
"This is quite a scene."
Torn's face was more grim than she had ever seen.
"Somehow, I'm not sure how, you killed my friend and hurt my partner."
His sword shushed out of its sheath.
"Defend yourself!"
The voice thundered in Kerrigan's head. Jindara's sword, still sheathed at her side, was closest. She grabbed the hilt and drew it. The black band seemed to disconnect the blade from the hilt. The sword was of the best balance she had ever held. Of course, it belonged to a swordmaster.
"Foolish girl,"
Torn said.
"You are no swordmaster. You dirty her blade by touching it. But you will die on mine."
Torn thrust without preamble, and Kerrigan barely deflected it. She tried to remember the exercises Arms Master Rendell had drilled into her head, and the hints and tricks Savano had taught her. But Torn was relentless, and all she could manage was to duck and block the onslaught of blows. Each strike from Torn jarred her body and numbed her arms from her fingers to her elbows. If there was any time she was going to die, it was now. Torn's speed and rhythm was a dance. Kerrigan had never seen anything like it, and was enthralled by his deadly skill. His feet barely shifted. He never swung the blade more than required. His economy of movement was grace itself. After just moments of swordplay, Torn raised his sword for the death blow, but time stilled. Cold filled Kerrigan's body. Not a chill, really. It was like being a glass filled with cold water. Then there was something else, an awareness of another. Her arms were buoyed by another strength, and her reflexes guided by another thought process. Her own awareness grew dim, and she became a bystander in her own body. Or was it her own body? 2 points of severe pain in her back twisted her insides. The action resumed, and the would-be death blow was miraculously blocked. "Raven, sweep to the side." The voice echoed from far away in her head. The same voice that had told her to fight and defend herself. The same voice that had tried to speak to her at the settlement.
"One and two and three and up thrust five."
The voice and her body matched and countered the rhythm of Torn's attack. She recognized some of the techniques named, but many more were new to her. All the various moves, the balance and steps, the angle of the cutting edge, fell into place within her,
in a way they hadn't when taught by Savano or Master Rendell. Was that shock registering on Torn's face as she blocked